Kia ora koutou. Welcome to the New Zealand General Practice Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Scott Jones. Earlier seasons of this podcast focused on joint practice. This season is an opportunity to listen in on monthly conversations I have with Dr. Dave Mapleston, organised for the Pinnacle GP Network. Dave shares insights into important clinical changes he picks up in his reading as a part-time GP and advisor to the Health and Disability Commissioner. I hope you enjoy.
Good day, Dave. How are you?
Morena. Yes, I'm not too bad. I've got a week of annual leave coming up, so that's always very inspiring.
Very nice. Looking forward to it. What are you going to be doing?
Actually doing a clinical governance workshop in Melbourne. AICG.
That's not annual.
Well, that's one day. That's one day. The other rest of the week will be exploring Melbourne. So, okay.
Well, I'll let you have that. So tell us about yourself, Dave.
Yes, I'm a GP and also do work in clinical governance for Pinnacle and some work for HDC.
And you update me and the rest of us on a variety of things that you read about, and that keeps helps to, well, it's a great conversation and keeps us all mindful of some of the most recent changes that are important for general practice in and our clinical work. So I'm looking forward to February's clinical snippets.
Let's head off, shall we?
Let's head off, yeah.
So the theme for much of the snippets this time is around prescribing. And again, my HDC work, I often see a lot of complaints around various aspects of prescribing, information provided to patients about side effects, just prescribing errors. And I have to quote quite often in my reports, excerpts from the Medical Council Statement of Good Prescribing Practice. So one of those excerpts is, be familiar with the indications, adverse effects, contraindications, major drug interactions, appropriate dosages, monitoring requirements, effectiveness and cost effectiveness of the medicines that you prescribe.
Is that all? Oh, that's fine. Okay, yeah.
No, that's one clause out of about 100. So do read the document when you have time.
Okay.
But just, yeah, so basically there's an expectation that we have a reasonable working knowledge of the medication we prescribe, and there's also an expectation under the Code of Rights that the patient's informed about, you know, common risks, etc. So the first aspect I'm looking at is ACE, ARB and statin prescribing. And it's just a reminder, again, a lot of you will know this, but just a reminder that it's important to keep an awareness of what you should and shouldn't be using during pregnancy. And this applies particularly to younger women with type 2 diabetes who are in the childbearing age group. But basically, NZF notes that ACE inhibitors should be avoided at all stages of pregnancy. Fetal skull defects have been reported following first trimester exposure to ACEs, although evidence of teratogenicity is inconclusive. In the second and third trimesters, ACE inhibitors can cause abnormalities, including fetal growth retardation, oligohydramnios, and fetal or neonatal renal failure. And fetal death in utero has also been reported. So pregnant women who are taking an ACE inhibitor should be changed to an alternative antihypertensive as soon as possible. And like ACE inhibitors, ARBs should be avoided in pregnancy, particularly in the second and third trimesters, as similar effects in that stage of pregnancy to those caused by ACE are expected. But NZF notes also that statins should be avoided in pregnancy as congenital anomalies have been reported and thought to be around the decreased synthesis of cholesterol possibly affecting fetal development. So the individual statin monographs state that the drug is contraindicated during the first trimester and adequate contraception is required during treatment and for 1 month afterwards. So this is basically all women of childbearing age who you're prescribing statins should be aware of the risk and be taking appropriate contraception during treatment with the statin and for 1 month afterwards. So that's the advice in the individual monographs. However, a 2022 meta-analysis, which I'll put a link to, noted that there are some patients for whom there may be significant benefit of maintaining statin therapy, in particular in the second and third trimesters, and the risk and benefit of statins treatment during pregnancy need to be evaluated in an individualized approach and every trimester apart. So I guess the message from that is certainly avoid during first trimester, but there may be situations where you probably discuss with the patient's cardiologist whether there might be grounds for reinstating the statin in the later stages of the pregnancy.
I'd have thought that given that there's a risk that 6 months of not taking a statin is not going to be significant risk in by far majority of people.
That's certainly presented as an argument, but I think the rationale from the meta-analysis and systematic review was that in fact the evidence behind these abnormalities in the second and third trimesters is pretty sketchy.
Yeah.
And a lot of it theoretical as much as actual.
Yeah.
But here's what stood out for me was that, you know, I haven't thought before about telling women in childbearing age and whom I'm prescribing statins that they should be using contraception, and there's a real risk of, you know, of getting pregnant on the statin.
And more younger women are having hypertension, diabetes, you know, the where these medications become much more likely to be prescribed. Yeah, it's when somebody presents who's pregnant, we will think about it, but this is about you have the potential to be pregnant. We need to think about it at that stage, so and make people aware and keep people aware when we're re-prescribing, then keeping people aware that this is a potential for them. It needs to become part of the routine conversation we have when we do a repeat prescription review.
Yeah, and again, I guess another reason to give people written information when you're commencing these meds. So the NZF patient information leaflets, I'm pretty sure cover this aspect. So,
yeah. Very good.
The second one's around monitoring. So, you know, many drugs require monitoring. This one we're looking at today particularly is lithium drug interactions, and it just comes from a September 2023 New Zealand Doctor article, which is quite a helpful refresher on general monitoring recommendations for patients on lithium, but particularly when you're adding or removing ACEs, diuretics, or NSAIDs. So they talk about the usual monitoring, looking at a reference range of 0.6 to 0.8 millimoles per litre for patients with chronic use of lithium, 3 to 6 monthly, depending on stability, serum lithium levels, electrolytes, and EGFR, 6 monthly thyroid, calcium, and weight, and annually, if age over 40 or obese, HbA1c lipids, and consider an ECG. Mm. But probably more news to me was the effect that these ACEs, diuretics, or NSAIDs can have on lithium levels, and hence the need for monitoring. So ACE inhibitors, if you're adding an ACE inhibitor to somebody on lithium, they suggest baseline serum lithium level and renal function tests, then weekly for 6 weeks or until stable. So for at-risk people, which are those with impaired renal function, volume depletion, or heart failure, consider further 2 weekly checks for another 6 weeks. The rationale for that being that 20 to 35% of people will have an increase in lithium levels if an ACE inhibitor is added to the regime, and that increase is usually around a third. The interaction can be delayed for up to 5 weeks, hence the recommendation to keep that weekly monitoring for 6 weeks. So it's important not to be reassured by steady lithium levels initially.
Mm.
There is an ARB interaction, but it's less likely, tends to be dose-dependent, and lesser increase in lithium levels of up to 20% after up to 5 weeks of treatment. So ACEs are probably the main culprit which need to be monitored. Diuretics, they suggest as a baseline serum lithium level and renal function tests, then weekly for 4 weeks. So if a thiazide needs to be introduced, there may be a rapid increase in lithium levels by 20 to 25% in 3 to 10 days, although the effect can be delayed. Loop diuretics have less impact, with potentially only up to a 20% increase in levels, and potassium-sparing diuretics don't appear to have any effect at all. So adding in a thiazide, weekly lithium level and renal function tests, and provided they're stable after 4 weeks, they can go back to the normal regime. So this also applies to dose changes. So if there's an alteration to the ACE inhibitor dose or thiazide diuretic dose, so the monitoring needs to be considered as well. And then NSAIDs, suggesting a baseline serum lithium level and renal function tests in weekly for 2 weeks or until stable. And the interaction is well described for decreasing lithium clearance and increasing its toxicity, although it's quite unpredictable. And while the average increase decrease in lithium clearance is usually only 10 to 25%, there's wide variation, especially in people with impaired renal function. And it's unlikely that COX-2 inhibitors would be any different to traditional NSAIDs regarding this interaction. And hopefully there won't be too many people whom you're co-prescribing ACEs, diuretics and NSAIDs, but yeah, it's a cumulative risk. So those patients are particularly at risk of developing lithium toxicity if not monitored adequately.
Yeah. I think lithium is like carbamazepine, erythromycin, sodium valproate. They're medications which always prompt me to look at interactions really carefully. I think what I learned from our conversations is not to skip over the automatic interaction warning that pops up with my PMS as lightly as I have done in at some stages in my career. And also using the New Zealand formulary interactions, I think it's Stockley's tool that's embedded in there is really, really helpful. But yeah, there are a few of these medications I've got embedded in my head, which always trigger interactions.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's certainly one to be wary of. And even just in your repeat prescribing protocols, it's one that it's particularly important to make sure that the monitoring requirements, just for even if there'd be no drugs added, that, you know, they're actually having their levels monitored
at least 6 monthly. So that you would actually list a certain number of medications in there where you say that, you know, you need to be making sure that people are being monitored, but in particular with regard to lithium methylphenidate and whatever
DMARDs and and particularly if we're deputizing, you know, repeat prescribing to other staff members. I think that you need to have a really robust repeat prescribing policy in that sort of situation. Later issue of New Zealand Doctor looked at shared care prescribing of clozapine, which I think a few of my colleagues do. And just a reminder that clozapine can only be initiated by a psychiatrist, but certainly in some localities, GPs and NPs become responsible for ongoing prescribing under the supervision of a psychiatrist or in conjunction with a mental health team. So they're usually patients, or they should be patients who are considered stable. And that means they've been taking clozapine continuously for 2 years, no mental health related admissions in the last 12 months, and are not taking other medications requiring close monitoring by a psychiatrist. And that they're adherent to treatment and appointments. So all patients on clozapine are required to register with either Clopine Central, which is that brand, Clopine brand monitoring system, or CareLink Plus, which is the other brand, Clozaril monitoring system. And they have to be registered by a registered medical practitioner. And then the prescribing physicians need to register themselves with the relevant monitoring system to be able to access patient information.
And the pharmacist as well.
And the pharmacist, absolutely. So there's quite a robust safety chain, I guess, if it's, you know, as long as the requirements are followed. Brand swapping is certainly discouraged and should occur only on the advice of the initiating clinician or team. And this is all because the adverse effect profile of clozapine is wide and can be severe, in particular agranulocytosis, severe constipation and cardiomyopathy, myocarditis. And there are specific requirements for pre-prescribing screening and subsequent monitoring, which are critical to reduce the risk of patient harm. There's practical information on those screening and monitoring requirements in a really good BPAC article and a SafeRx publication, which I've put links in the written document. Mm. And just important from, you know, if we're managing, or even if we're not managing the prescribing, if we become aware of a change in the patient's cigarette smoking or caffeine intake. So with respect to cigarette smoking, clozapine levels are reduced by cigarette smoking. It's not the nicotine, it's the constituents of smoke that's responsible. So even if they go on to NRT, if they've stopped smoking, you will still get the alteration in clozapine levels. And so elevated clozapine levels up to double baseline mercury when patients stop smoking, not affected by NRT. Mm. Therefore, if patients stop smoking, it's advisable to monitor plasma clozapine levels, and dose reduction may be required in conjunction with the mental health service advice. And conversely, if you become aware they've started smoking during treatment, the therapeutic effect of clozapine may be reduced. But interestingly, the concentration of clozapine can also be significantly increased by a high caffeine intake, which is more than 400 milligrams a day. which is not, I think it's 10 cans of cola, but only three double shot espressos, which is my intake.
Yes.
Not the Coke, but the coffee.
Yeah.
But to be aware that colas, tea, and many energy drinks contain significant amounts of caffeine. And again, it's not uncommon to see all sorts of patients with that can of V or Mother or whatever clasped in their hand on a continuing basis. So clozapine levels can subsequently decrease by nearly 50% after a five-day caffeine period in someone who's previously had a high caffeine intake. So this, I guess, things to ask about when you're monitoring your clozapine patients. So the article concluded every time a patient comes in, a clozapine patient, there's an opportunity to query about adverse effects with a focus on smoking status and bowel habits, check they're taking their medication appropriately and offer lifestyle advice. Blood test results should be checked and compared with baseline. It's also important to ensure patients are aware of the need for blood tests to be done on the day they are due. And I've just put a reference or a link to the Porirua protocol, which is an evidence-based bowel management regime for patients taking clozapine. So patients taking clozapine do die from severe fecal impaction or have been known to die. So the Porirua protocol is just a simple stepwise protocol, starting with Senna or docusate and Senna, and then basically ramping up depending on how the bowel function is. So it's an evidence-based, easily accessible protocol that that you can follow. So on that stool note,
I spoke to one of the people who are part of the monitoring team associated with the clozapine, and it was really interesting. There's one person who's looking after each of those data sets around all of the people on either brand of clozapine. So I thought that was pretty surprising for the whole of Australasia. So she knew the 1500 patients who are on a particular brand of medication in New Zealand. And just to be aware that all they're doing is making sure that the blood tests are done on time and regularly for people who are picking up the prescriptions. So they will send an alert if somebody doesn't have their blood tests done, but they're not providing any other information or monitoring or support for the program. Their job given to them by MedSafe is to make sure that people are getting their blood tests done, and particularly looking for agranulocytosis. So they're particularly looking at full blood count and particularly the white cell counts within that. So although it's great to have them as part of the safety net, they're only a tiny part of the safety net in the shared care environment.
And are they alerting you if there's a significantly abnormal result, as well as if a test is missed?
That's a really good point. And yes, I think they do, but their key role is to make sure that the blood tests are done.
So it's still our responsibility to be checking the result, even if we've had no alert from anybody.
Yeah, speaking to her, she was really compassionate, really dedicated to this work. But you can can imagine the volume of stuff that she's dealing with on a daily basis. I have to say, I hope she's doing something as else at the same time, to be honest, because I can't imagine that being the only task that you've got. But
yeah, it'd be slightly soul destroying, I think.
Yeah. Anyway, so just to be aware of that, but as you say, it's the people ordering the test are the people who are responsible for managing the result.
Yep.
Yeah.
So sticking on the prescribing theme, but looking at an example of equity in prescribing, and this is around prescribing in Māori with peripheral arterial disease. This is a review of a paper in the issue 106 of the Māori Health Review. And it looked at a Midland recent retrospective study from the Midland region on prescribing of cardioprotective medications and the impact on survival for patients with peripheral arterial disease that undergo intervention. So this was looking at patients that had various vascular interventions for PAD and retrospectively looking at their prescribing. So these are patients with obviously quite severe PAD. So overall, 80.7% of the patients had received a prescription for antihypertensive medication, 77.4% for lipid-lowering medication, and 89.9% for antithrombotic medication. And prescribing of all three concurrently is regarded as best medical therapy.
Yeah.
So patients with concomitant ischemic heart disease quite reasonably were more likely to be prescribed cardioprotective medication. Women were less likely to be prescribed lipid-lowering medication than men. and younger patients were less likely to be prescribed lipid-lowering medication than older patients. However, Maori men were less likely to be prescribed antiplatelet medication compared with non-Maori, although they were more often prescribed antihypertensive agents, and there was no significant difference in statin prescribing. Which I found kind of reassuring in some ways that there is some equity, at least in some of the prescribing. But the antiplatelet medication significantly lower in non-Maori men. And lipid-lowering and antiplatelet medication showed a survival advantage, while antihypertensive and anticoagulant medication did not. The best medical therapy was associated with better survival after adjustment for age, sex, end-stage renal failure, and presence of limb-threatening ischemia. So again, I'm not sure why it would be that you're prescribing your Maori patients with PAD, antihypertensives, and statins without an antiplatelet agent, but here is the evidence. But just on a side issue, on an equity theme, there's a really great article from Cook Street Medical Centre in Palmerston North in the January edition of GP Voice about their equity journey and outcomes as a practice, which has got some quite interesting ideas on how they promoted equity within their practice, including engaging local Māori providers, local marae, getting input from Māori providers into how they could do it. So worth a glimpse.
We found a significant difference when we appointed, if you like, or developed a relationship with the iwi and had a kaumātua appointed to the surgery over in Aupōtiki. It made it just, there were so many flow-on effects from that improved relationship that it was, yeah, it was really palpable. So, yeah, I'll have a look for that. But again, you know, when I think it was Kyle Eggleton in Auckland had, you know, done just a simple audit of prescribing of statins. And, you know, despite being somebody who works in a high Māori community with, you know, all the best will in the world to do the right thing, when stepping back and actually looking at the hard evidence of what actual outcomes are being achieved can be quite revealing. And, you know, we should all be making that step, because assuming that you're doing the right thing, it is going to make an ass out of you and me, as this phrase goes.
Yeah. And I think the prescribing is one part, but the checking that in fact you're prescribed, you know, this patient is getting a 3-monthly prescription as part of it as well, to make sure it's being taken appropriately to get the full benefits.
Absolutely. And I totally get that it's not, there are a whole range of different factors. There's doctor factors, there's patient factors, there's society factors that impact on these outcomes. But once again, we need to step back and look at it and ask ourselves some hard questions and act.
Yeah, I think the clinical governance stuff that I'm doing at the moment, the importance of involving the consumer really from any the start of any clinical governance process onwards is really important. And in some ways, if you select those patients who aren't taking their medication, for example, and use them to say, well, what would it take, you know, why aren't you, and what would it take to encourage you to take it regularly? What are the barriers? Might help improve the issue.
I think you can do that on a one-on-one basis. You can ask the people in your practice who have a relationship, whether that's the Kaiāwhina or a nurse or yourself. You know, asking people who are struggling to, you know, just spend a bit of time with you and exploring that can be really revealing. And so it doesn't have to be a, you know, monthly meeting of a patient access group, although that's, you know, if you've got those, that's fantastic. But, you know, you can do mini focus groups and things to explore these sorts of issues and involve patients, involve the consumer in these things. So, but not that we do it perfectly, any of us, I don't think, but yeah.
We can aspire.
And you know, trying, again, that one of our people from our Māori health team said, you know, start small, do something. Don't think that this is far too difficult, so you never start. You know, the just doing it once for one patient is a good start.
And seeing what others have done, which is just why, yeah, I made the reference to the Cook Street Medical Centre, yeah, articles. So, that's rounding off with a few little things. So January MedSafe released a monitoring communication regarding vildagliptin, Galvus or Galvamet, which there's just some evolving evidence that there may be a risk of ileus associated with use of the medication. Insufficient evidence currently to confirm the association, but there's biological plausibility behind it because the DPP-4 inhibitors act by inhibiting the breakdown of glucagon-like peptide, which has a role in inhibition of gastrointestinal motility.
So can you say that really quickly 10 times for me, Dave?
So all to do with glucagon. But basically, the message from that is if you have any patients that are diagnosed with an ileus who have been taking or are taking Galvus or Galvumet, even if there's no apparent direct link, just to report it using the CALM reporting process so they can build up a bit of a database and decide whether there's a need for more formal warning or whatever.
Right.
So vildagliptin and ileus. A couple of resources. So the online mental health provider Just a Thought has launched CBT courses for pregnant women. So there's one, or pregnant and recently pregnant women, one entitled Pregnancy Wellbeing and one Postnatal Wellbeing for women who experience depression and anxiety during the perinatal journey. I've talked about Just a Thought before, but there's just a real wealth of online CBT assistance for a whole variety of mental health issues. The courses are evidence-based and free of charge. So you can formally refer your patients if you're registered online as a clinician, and you then get basically feedback on the progress of your patient and the ability to kind of contribute online to their journey. But the patient can also self-access, which means you don't get that feedback, but they can certainly still do it.
Yep.
And the second one is for those of us like me who probably need to brush up and improve my dermatoscopy skills. The Educational Provider Skin Cancer Symposiums offers a variety of online and in-person courses, so some quite detailed, others more introductory, but they're aiming to really facilitate accurate and timely diagnosis of skin cancers, but particularly melanoma. So they're currently offering a complimentary online mini course on the basics of dermatoscopy and diagnosing melanomas. And I have, there is a link to where you can register. I've put a link into the written information. Nice. And the goal of the course is described as to facilitate the basic understanding of the visual red flags of diagnosing melanoma. In all of the cases presented, we include clinical and dermatoscopic images. And some of the diagnosis will be evident in the clinical image, and reviewing the dermatoscopic image will further reinforce this. In some examples, the diagnosis is only evident in the dermatoscopic image. Mm. So it looks like it would be quite a good introductory or refresher on the patterns that help you recognize or distinguish melanoma.
And one of those things, because it is pattern recognition, repeated exposure to it is the way that we learn. We need to do refresher courses in this as well, because I think it's really easy to slip into a little bit of complacency around this when you're doing it, you know, three or four times a week, or you know, once or twice a day even. You know, people who only deal with skin cancer are absolute experts at dermatoscopy, you know, but for the jobbing clinicians, it's one of those skills that you need to keep up. I will link into that.
Yeah, but like reading x-rays.
Next time I've got some annual leave, Dave, I'll
devote it to improving your dermatoscopy skills. Yeah. And just rounding up, and I'm sure most people would be aware of this because it's been released to the public just around the new COVID vaccine coming out, but there is you might get questioned about how effective is it going to be. So Mana Tuhawara confirmed at the end of December that a vaccine to combat the newer strains of COVID-19 has been approved by MedSafe and will be available to New Zealanders in time for winter 2024. So it's the COVID-19 XBB.1.5 Omicron vaccine approved for the 12 plus age group, with no plan reported for any changes in current eligibility criteria. But eligible people are encouraged not to defer any booster shots that are due of the existing vaccine in view of the prevalence of COVID-19 in the community at the moment. So don't put off your booster right at the moment, otherwise you're at risk. So that the most prevalent subvariant currently internationally and in New Zealand is actually JN.1, but the receipt of updated vaccine containing the XBB.1.5 spike protein is anticipated to provide protection against JN.1. So if you have very educated patients saying, "Oh, but you know, JN.1 is the villain at the moment," you can reassure them that there certainly is cross protection with the new vaccine.
Yeah, so 14 deaths from COVID, 6,312 new cases in the reported over the week up until Sunday. We're talking about towards the end of February 2024, a 7-day rolling average of 900, just over 900 new cases a day in New Zealand. So, you know, we're actually in the throes of a slight upswing in the number of cases. And yeah, who knows what the future is going to be, although it's likely that we're going to settle into a sort of a business as usual around this. I see that testing with free tests are going to be available until June in New Zealand, but there's no clarity around what's going to happen after that. And obviously, if we can't test, it's going to be quite hard to treat. So I assume we'll be given access to tests for people in the most vulnerable groups, you know, the elderly, etc. The people who most benefit from antivirals. But again, I'm making assumptions.
But I mean, I think as we predicted, it's almost become business as usual.
Yeah, it is. And I understand why we're not talking about it as much. But yeah, we've got to get the balance right with this. This is still the most deadly infectious disease in New Zealand. It's the commonest cause of death from an infectious disease in New Zealand currently. And it's we're in an endemic or a
phase.
Yeah.
It's I've just finished reading a book in three
very
parts.
Good. Well done, Dave.
Sorry, three
well
parts.
Done.
From 1893, 1993, and 2093. And the whole 2093 section is set in the US. And there have been multiple pandemics following the pandemics from the early 2000s. And society is totally broken down. I mean, quite scary and even scarier because you can actually see how this, you know, it's not just far-fetched science fiction. And these are all zoonoses that come across to humans but become increasingly severe over time. And interestingly, the whole management of them has become totally political. So factions against containment centres and quarantine, etc., who, when they gain power, they kill all the scientists that have been researching, and then the more conservative elements take over again and the scientists get reinstated, for those that are still alive, and the containment centres get put back into place again. But yeah, so just, you know, politics as well as the science.
How are you sleeping, Dave? Are you okay?
It was a very long book, so some parts of it did put you to sleep, but it's called To Paradise, it's called.
To Paradise.
Hanya Yanagihara, who wrote another totally depressing book, but gripping book called This Little Life. But anyway, I won't bore you with any more of my...
Not at all, not at all. Though I think we might need to add this as a regular section on the podcast for, you know, what's Dave reading now? Hey, thanks, Dave. That's absolutely awesome. So thinking about people who are of childbearing potential, and particularly those who are hypertensive or have diabetes, and making sure that we're warning them about the potential impacts of ACE, ARBs, and statins if they were to become pregnant, the need for contraception, and you know, maybe even looking for alternatives. Lithium drug interactions and shared care, clozapine, and the complexity of that. And I think we're going to see more and more patients on these sort of shared care plans for things like lithium and DMARDs, as more patients get on those and the more stable patients are living in the community on those sorts of medications. There's that challenge around equity, which, and particularly around, you raised that study around peripheral arterial disease, and, you know, a good reminder for us to not just assume that we're doing the right thing, but to step back and look at the data around that. The MedSafe monitoring communication around vildagliptin, and a reminder to use the CALM system which is great for, you know, any interactions. It's becoming increasingly easy to do that online as well. And then those resources around postnatal and antenatal depression from the Just a Thought organization, the Skin Cancer Symposium and Dermatoscopy, and our discussion about the upcoming new change to the COVID vaccine. But don't delay, get your boosters. I had mine a couple of weeks ago and thoroughly enjoyable experience. Thank you very much. So thanks, Dave. Enjoy. When are you off on holiday?
Heading off on Saturday.
On Saturday, okay. So we'll touch base again towards the end of next month.
Sounds great.
Thanks a lot, Dave. And ka kite, enjoy your holiday. And don't do too much work.
I won't. Thanks, everybody, and thanks, listeners. Bye.
Thanks for listening. Please like and share this podcast if you found it useful. The show notes on the podcast website contain links to all the resources that we discussed. A video version of this podcast is available on the Pinnacle Practice website at pinnacle.co.nz. Ka kite anō.